So we've got the kind of the complexity of dispatching lots of things in a very short period of time. We've got the kind of the information shortfall of having many, many smaller assets with perhaps not the same quality of information coming into the control room. I think we also have the 15-minute rule at the moment, which is linked to kind of the typical dispatch duration of a battery. Could you give a little bit more colour around perhaps how that might be changing?
As you say, 15 minutes sort of assumed to be the typical duration of a battery. So we have a limit at the minute that we will only dispatch a battery for 15 minutes because we can be sure that it will deliver that. Beyond that, it becomes much more uncertain. With some of the changes that we're proposing around information flows and other things, we can actually lift that rule off and say, actually, if you give us different information, we don't need to put a 15 minute limit on our dispatch instructions because we would have more certainty about what you're able to do and then whether you're delivering or not against what you've said you'll do.
Hello everybody, welcome back for another episode of Transmission. In this week's episode, guest host Ed Porter is joined by ESO's Claire Dichter. Over the conversation, they dive deep into the balancing mechanism. If you are enjoying Transmission, please hit subscribe and give us a rating. It helps us reach a wider audience. And with that, let's jump in.
Hello and welcome to today's edition of Transmission. We are joined by ESO and we're going to be talking about the balancing mechanism and storage and the balancing mechanism. And we've been joined by Claire. Claire, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. And I think we're just going to get straight into it. So could we start off with what is the balancing mechanism and what does it do?
Nice, easy question to start off with. So in the GB, the wholesale market is designed to self-balance. So everyone who's a participant in that market, whether they're a generator or a supplier or like a non-physical trader, so someone who's just speculating, they're incentivized to balance their position. So that happens over a really long time frame, down to what something we call gate closure. Okay. So every day is split into half hour blocks called settlement periods. And when you're an hour away from the settlement period, the wholesale market stops trading its physical positions. And then the system operator, so our control room, knows how the market has like resolved itself and basically whether it's got any issues it needs to solve. Once you've had that gate closure of the wholesale market stopping trading, that's where the balancing mechanism kicks in. So it's designed to be an operational tool for the system operator to really fine tune what it needs to keep the electricity system running. So historically that would have been, I don't know, if a power station suddenly tripped off or if your demand forecast was a bit low and it turned out higher, we'd be using the balancing mechanism to do that fine tuning. And historically, we would have sort of reset about 2 or 3% of the entire market through the balancing mechanism. How that works is people submit things called BOAs, which stand for bids and offers. So people submit a price and say, this is how much that I am willing to pay or be paid to either increase my generational consumption or reduce it. The ESO stacks all of that into a price stack and then goes through them to select all of the offers it needs to balance the system.
Okay. So loads of process there. Let's just make sure we've got that all lined up. So we said sort of a long way before delivery, so maybe 3 years prior to a particular settlement period, we start thinking about supply and demand. And so when you say we're going to be balanced in that settlement period, what we mean by that is both supply and demand match, and there's not too much electricity. There's not a shortfall. So that's the first part. And then people trade through open markets kind of up until that point, gate closure. And then at gate closure, we think that the market should be as close to balance as possible. And then effectively everything is passed over to the hands of the control room or the system operator, who, as you said, will consider the BOAs that they have. So bids and offers, and bids generally to turn down and offers to turn up in sort of conventional generation or battery speak, offers to discharge and bids to charge. And so the control room will see all of those sort of bids and offers and be able to work out what the cheapest bid or offer is to use for the particular problem that they're trying to solve. And that's how they will guide us from gate closure through to delivery.
Absolutely. And historically, that would have been relatively easy, which is hugely undermining what we do in the control room. But it would have primarily been a megawatt difference would be the problem we were trying to solve. So if you suddenly, like I said, if a power station suddenly tripped off, you were short of megawatts, you would procure some more. Mm-hmm. As we're rapidly going through the transition to a decarbonized power system, where mm-hmm. we've got a much higher penetration of renewable power, the problems that the control room need to solve are much more complicated. Mm-hmm. Like the power system doesn't just work anymore. So when you have a power system that's running with loads of conventional generation, say coal or gas or something, mm-hmm. the physics of mm-hmm. the system work quite well. So you'll have heard of terms like the inertia on the system and the volts and things like that.
Okay.
When you've got a conventional system, the system is designed that broadly all of that stuff just works. Once you're in a high renewable system, the system isn't designed for that. So your inertia is lower. You might have more issues with voltage. So the control room is no longer just trying to make up megawatt shortfalls or too many megawatts. It's also trying to solve voltage problems or maybe generation being in the wrong place in the country.
So we're saying that there's kind of we're not just talking about power these days, you know, being a megawatt short or being a megawatt long. We're also saying there are other things that we're trying to solve for, like inertia or voltage or a locational issue. And maybe let's put this into practice, right? So why is this a hard thing to do? Or perhaps like what are particularly difficult days for the balancing mechanism to cope with?
So I always describe it a bit like a game of whack-a-mole, which you're possibly not old enough to remember.
whack-a-mole is in my range for sure.
The control room will look and say, okay, this is what the market has provided me. This is where the market is closed. Mm-hmm. What's my first issue that I'm looking at? And it might be that it's a really windy day.
Yeah.
So there's loads of wind generation in Scotland. Mm-hmm. Now there isn't enough transmission capacity, so there aren't enough overhead wires to bring all of the generation that's connected in Scotland down into England, where a lot of the demand is. So what we would have to do is we would have to buy off the generation in Scotland. So it's a bit like saying we've sold 120 tickets to get on a train to go over the border. Mm-hmm. All of those 120 ticket holders unexpectedly turned up, but we've only actually got 100 seats, so we need to buy 20 of the tickets back.
Okay.
But once we've done that, we're then 20 tickets short in that mm-hmm. example. So we've created a megawatt imbalance, so we have to buy the megawatts somewhere else where we can accept them.
So in that example, you need 120 people in England and they start off in Scotland, but your train can only take 100. So you buy the tickets back in Scotland, but then you also have to pay some people to turn up in England.
In England, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So we would do that. And then you go, okay, I've solved that issue. What is my next one? If it's a really windy day, you might have really low inertia.
And how does that happen?
The simple analogy is if you've got a system with high inertia, it's a bit like dropping a stone into a swimming pool full of treacle. So you could drop the stone in, and it wouldn't really ripple very far at all, so it wouldn't create a disturbance.
Yeah.
If you've got a system with low inertia, it's like dropping a stone into a pool full of water, and you'll see the ripples travel on. And those disturbances that go across the system cause all sorts of protection that's in place on the system to operate. So you might say a generator somewhere else in the country might shut down because its protection has spotted that there's a disturbance on the system, so it closes down to protect itself.
Okay. And well, just kind of just on that, right? So you're saying in a high wind day you might have lower inertia on the grid. So I understand that. And then around the sort of the ripple moving through the system, that's also understood. Well, how does a ripple, like what's the stone in that analogy? What causes the ripple to start?
Could be anything. So it could be a lightning strike.
Okay.
It could be if say one of the interconnectors trips off, it can travel right across the grid, obviously very quickly.
Yeah.
So there's two ways that we deal with that. One is that we buy synthetic inertia. So we try and recreate inertia. It's really complicated, but you're just trying to arrest that disturbance happen. The other one, which is where batteries come in, is that we will hold what we call response. So that's batteries and other technologies that are connected to the system that either automatically detect that a disturbance has happened, so they will see it in the frequency trace, or we instruct them to do something and they will react to counteract the effect of the disturbance.
Okay, and this is, we would kind of talk about this as low and high responses in terms of from response services. What's a low service, what's a high service?
So that just refers to frequency. So with all of the services that we buy for the system operator, ultimately it comes down to managing the frequency second by second and keeping it as close to 50 hertz as we can. Mm-hmm. When you have things happen on the system, your frequency can run higher or your frequency can run lower. We have operational limits that we have to keep within, because once you go beyond operational limits, you can start to damage equipment that's connected to the system. So generator turbines and things can get damaged.
Okay.
Worst case scenario is that if you can't arrest a frequency run, you would end up with a blackout because the system would effectively collapse.
Okay. And then I'm always trying to stay away from things like the system will effectively collapse in this, because in reality, I mean, that happens very rarely in a system like this because of the amount of response and reserve type services we have available. But just to kind of go into how storage kind of fits into the sort of those low and high services. So in a high service, we're talking about high frequency. So batteries will be charging off high frequency to bring that frequency down. And in a low service, your batteries will be discharging to bring that frequency up.
Yeah, and the good thing about batteries is that they're so quick to respond. Because we've got this like very light, low inertia system where disturbances can travel quickly, a battery can act, you know, pretty much instantaneously. So it can react very quickly. So we basically run the system very differently to how we used to, because we can deal with the problems much quicker.
Okay. And just on the analogy of the sort of stone dropping into the pool, if you are like, are some power stations more valuable than others? So imagine if that stone is dropped in the shallow end, is it helpful to sort of have your power station kind of in the shallow end near to where that sort of emergence, that ripple starts? Or does it sort of not matter where it is and it could kind of be anywhere in the country?
It can be anywhere. Say different power stations have got different characteristics which are useful in different situations. If you have a very light, low inertia system and you have a disturbance on it, it can be felt right across the system. So it can travel very quickly, particularly across a low inertia system.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense to me. And when does the control room get involved in this? So you've mentioned that you can pull some levers to help to manage things like inertia, or you might be coming into the start of assessment period and thinking, okay, things aren't going to be quite right. When does the control room get involved? Because do they start just an hour out, or does planning for that start well in advance?
Planning starts, say, for that particular half hour period, planning would have started for that 10 to 15 years before.
Okay.
So we're looking now at the mid 2030s, what the mix on the system is going to be and what services we need. But if I kind of fast forward to kind of two-ish years out, that's when we buy things called ancillary services.
Okay.
So we have a suite of services that we will buy that, depending on the design of the product, they're all a bit different. We will either buy something to help with a particular, so it might be a frequency response service, or it might be something called restoration, which is what we use if we do have a shutdown of part of the system. It's how we sort of kickstart it again. Sometimes it's more of a sort of option and exercise type design where we might buy the capability upfront and then we'll exercise it within real time.
Okay. So frequency response, I know, and things like restoration, I understand. Option and exercise, that's maybe a new one. How does that, or what's an example of that?
Yeah, so that's more of a kind of just how we design particular products. So it might be that we will buy capability to make sure it's available in the settlement period, and then the control room will dispatch it.
Okay.
We do that particularly for units that aren't operating in the balancing mechanism. So there are assets that aren't in the balancing mechanism that we will sort of buy them through an ancillary service, and then the control room can dispatch them.
Yeah.
Not through the balancing mechanism, but still in the same time frames.
So I know in sort of previous winters, with National Grid have, you know, ESO and the control room have had access to bringing coal units back online. Is that an example of kind of the option and exercise, or is that that's a different product?
It is how the contracts are designed, but things like contingency coal units are completely held out of the market.
Okay.
So they're not allowed to operate in the market because they would distort the normal operation of the market.
Yeah.
We can only use them in certain circumstances, and the contracts are designed to absolutely minimise the impact on like the proper financial workings of the market.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense to me. So one thing that we have kind of just talked about a little bit here is we've talked about assets being registered in the balancing mechanism. And that brings us on to BMUs and non-BMUs. What's a BMU and what's a non-BMU?
So really simply, a BMU, that stands for balancing mechanism unit. Non-BMU is not a balancing mechanism unit. And they are assets that are either making themselves available to the control room in the balancing mechanism, or we procure them through a different route. If an asset makes itself available in the balancing mechanism, there's a whole process that you have to go through to be able to do that, which involves registering your assets. You have to accede to the balancing and settlement code. So there's a huge document with loads of rules in it that you have to comply with. There'll be all sorts of rules around metering data that you have to provide. And there's rules as well around communications links. So making sure you've got an appropriately secure and robust comms link that the control room can communicate with you.
And so that's helpful for the control room because they can see kind of exactly what's happening on that site. They can see whether it's live, what options they have to turn it up, turn it down. What's the opposite of that then? What's a non-BMU?
So a non-BMU is a way of recognising that actually operating in the balancing mechanism can be too much of a hurdle for some to pass. Like, obviously there's a cost to all of that, and it might be that you have a particular business model or you're at a particular stage in your life cycle that that's not viable to do. So a non-BMU allows a route to market for an asset without passing all of those hurdles.
Okay.
The control room can still dispatch it in that settlement period using just a different, you know, dispatch tool, but it is separate. So like obviously with the balancing mechanism, if you picture it in your head, there's a screen on a desk with all of the units stacked up, separate screen with anything that's not in the balancing mechanism. Okay. So you're kind of managing two different stacks, if you like.
And with the control room engineers, they are having to do this every single minute of every single day. Time is really precious to them. And so where there is a one screen with the assets on and another screen over here with a separate list of assets on, it's kind of more complication to be juggling across. Do you think that there is, over time, do you think we'll end up with more BMUs or more non-BMUs?
I think so. So it is a really hard job in the control room. I've done a couple of guest shifts. Hands down, it's the hardest thing I've ever done. It's really nerve-wracking because ultimately what they do, so we talked a little bit about the control room. There's three people that manage the frequency, and they are effectively sitting at their desk and watching the little squiggly line that shows what the frequency is. And when it starts to go in a direction that's unexpected, they do something about it. That's really difficult to do. You have to be really concentrated on it. And you're right, as we've transitioned from a system that's, you know, dominated by conventional generation, so a few big assets, to one that's increasingly becoming sort of accessed by lots and lots of small assets. When you're sat there balancing the system second by second, you need to be able to move really quickly. As with everything in the power industry, all of the systems and the procedures and the rules and everything are designed more or less as they were at like privatization at the end of the 80s.
Yes.
So there's a massive shift the industry needs to go on to open all of that up and kind of enable the transition. One of those things that is happening is us shifting all of our procedures and our IT systems so that we are able to better operate in that world, which means being able to issue instructions to units faster and to be able to issue more instructions than we would have originally designed the systems for.
Okay. And then taking that back to kind of the like, if we imagine kind of maybe half of the assets today are non-BMUs and half the assets are BMUs, over time, as that system gets better at dispatching assets, do we think that they're like, would we expect to kind of see more BMUs coming online, or do we think that it'll shift towards kind of there being more non-BMUs?
So we've got a whole host of different things over the next few years to improve access into the markets and improve the way that we do things. One of those is that we're actually going to consolidate effectively the list that we see in the control room. So you wouldn't see a difference between, and you'd be able to dispatch just as quickly across both of them. So taking a lot of the sort of split second decision points away from the people doing it, allowing them to sort of make a decision and then it's all automated rather than them kind of having to make five decisions to do something.
So I think I understand. So you're almost saying at the moment we've kind of got two systems, we want to bring it all into one system, and the control room and the control room engineers just want to say, look, I just want power in a very sort of simplistic way. I don't really mind whether it's a BM or non-BM. That's what I would like. And then it's up to the owners and operators of those individual assets to pick which one of those registrations they would like.
Yeah, if I put it really simply, although this is how it happens. So the control engineer at the minute will say, oh, I need power maybe in this location or something. Okay. And they'll go, right, these are my options. I need two of those. So I need to write two instructions, and they'll issue the instructions.
Right.
With all of the new capability that we're releasing into the control room, the control engineer will be able to go, I need this amount of power in this location, and the system will issue the instructions for them based on what's available in that stack. So it massively increases the capacity of the control room in terms of issuing instructions.
Yeah, and we're gonna come back onto that under OBP in a moment. But maybe before we go, so actually a bit maybe a silly question from me: you three engineers to manage frequency. Why do you need three? It feels is that so? Like you can have lunch and sort of go to the loo, and there's still one left, or are there three different things that need to be managed?
So they don't leave the desks while they're on shift unless they get covered. They can't. That makes it sound like they're chained to the desk. They're not chained to the desk, but you can't leave. You need to get someone to cover. The reason that there's three is it's split into the national balancing engineer and then two zonal engineers. One looks after the north and one looks after the south. So the national balancing engineer is ultimately accountable for frequency. So they call the shots, if you like. And what they will do is they will liaise with their two zonal engineers, but they'll be giving them guidance and instructions on what to do. So, you know, maybe I'm anticipating this problem in the south zone. Can you get me X, Y, and Z? And the zonal engineer will do that. It's the same for the north. Mm-hmm. the national balancing engineer will be sat there basically watching the frequency trace. The national balancing engineer will be sat there watching the little signal on the TV to show when Coronation Street is going to end, and they'll have something on standby to, you know, fire up or dispatch whatever as and when that happens.
So there's one national balancing engineer who oversees frequency, and then there's a north and south split where you are looking to take actions to remedy the frequency across those.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Okay, I think I'm there. And no one can leave the desk, but they don't want to leave their desk. They're having a good time. Okay, great. I think I've got it. Okay, so and then just within sort of ESO's role, you can't own batteries and you can't own assets. But if I could put a sort of hypothetical question to you, if you could magically have more of, let's say, I can a 1 gigawatt, 10 gigawatt hour battery, and you could just kind of put it anywhere you like. What would be helpful? Is it, do you kind of think, oh, you know what, you were mentioning the example earlier of we might have too much wind in Scotland and not enough generation in England. It might be nice to have more batteries in Scotland to help capture some of that wind, or it might be nice to have more batteries in England to kind of cover for when there might be too much wind and not enough transmission capacity. If you kind of could magically have some storage on the network, do you ever think about where it would go?
So yes, it's a bit like batteries and all sorts of storage has got loads of different applications. So as you say, they can help with what we call transmission constraints. So where it's difficult to get all of the generation that's in one part of the country to a different part of the country. So they can help with that. Mm-hmm. They're just generally helpful with frequency. So frequency is quite often, you know, it's national, it's not local. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that we're not allowed to own any assets or anything. We're actually currently in a process to separate out from our current owner and become an independent system operator, which we own by government. As we do that, one of the things that we're going to pick up is we're going to create and publish something called a Strategic Spatial Energy Plan.
Okay.
Which has got an acronym.
It must have an acronym.
But that will start us to give some of those indications, say for particular technology types, where mm-hmm. would they be best placed around the country to provide maximum benefit?
Yeah. Okay. I think that makes sense. That makes sense to me. And it's a question I think we get from industry quite a lot, is this sort of, okay, where should I be putting this? Like, and it's quite a hard question to answer. So yeah, interested to hear that is coming. Disappointed to hear that you haven't quite decided on the acronym just yet, because that's going to be, we do need another one for sure. Okay. So then perhaps moving into the more detailed side of this. So on from kind of the general, and we've already kind of started making this change, but on from the more general kind of how does the BM work to specifically things that are happening near term. So we have the OBP coming soon, or it's already in progress. What's the OBP?
So OBP stands for Open Balancing Platform, and it is, how to put it, it's starting to modernize the way that we schedule and dispatch assets in the control room. So when people talk about the balancing mechanism, they might be talking about the market. That is generally people outside of the ESO were talking about the sort of concept of a market, so the balancing mechanism. But balancing mechanism is actually the IT system as well that runs it. So there's a really complicated algorithm that sits underneath the balancing mechanism, this big IT platform. As I said, that's been sort of underpinning the way that we schedule and dispatch for a long time. Open Balancing Platform is moving to a sort of more agile, modular system, which gives us a lot more flexibility. So it automates a lot of the things that we do manually at the minute, but it is also modular as opposed to one huge system, which means that it sets us up better for the future. So as the market continues to develop, we can update and kind of evolve our systems quicker, because it's not just one big, huge, scary thing that we're trying to modify. It's like modules that are built together.
Okay, that makes sense. And I think the storage industry broadly is quite excited to where OBP might be able to bring dispatch in the balancing mechanism, because it's a new revenue source for storage in comparison to not so much new, but it might be an improved revenue source to kind of what they've seen in the past. But it's not just kind of one upgrade, is it? So within OBP, you've got things like bulk dispatch that is part of OBP and will be delivered, I think, in December of this year. But that's not the full OBP, right? So there's kind of lots of different parts of it.
Yeah, so OBP is a huge program and it will run for a few years and be sort of releasing a number of releases during that time. The first release, you're right, is this December. That's got a whole host of capability in it, but the main one that I think battery, the sort of owners or optimizers will be interested in is this bulk dispatch tool that we refer to. So that's what I mentioned earlier, where currently we have to issue a single instruction to a single unit, and that capability that we're releasing through OBP will allow us to simultaneously instruct multiple units. So that in conjunction with other changes that are coming in that allow us to issue the instructions faster. So it takes us about 30 seconds to issue a single instruction at the minute. We have changes also going in this quarter that would bring that down to 10 seconds.
Okay.
That sounds like not a big deal.
Hmm.
But if you think that if we see something happen on the system and we want to instruct our reserve services, so that's kind of the capability that we have on hold that we can say, we need you now, and like, go. At the minute, we can issue one instruction at a time. It takes us 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So if we want to instruct 20 batteries, that's an awful lot of instructions that we have to write. With this new capability, it allows us to do one instruction in 10 seconds and just send it out. So that hugely opens up the route to market for batteries in that instance, because it takes away the time constraints that we have.
Yeah, I think we're super excited to see that come through and to kind of track the impact that will have. Certainly, bulk dispatch should improve kind of the use of batteries in the BM. But I suppose that won't answer all of the questions, right? Because there are other limitations to batteries in the BM currently.
Yeah, so I think a big one is information. So we operate according to data. So we can see what units are doing in the sort of days gone by when we had CCGTs on the system. We still do, but when it was dominated by sort of stations the size of CCGTs, if something happened to one of them, you could see it in the frequency trace and you would see it in their real-time data immediately. Yeah. So you kind of knew what was happening. You knew how to deal with it. As we've got more and more smaller assets on the system, it makes that much harder. So finding a way sort of together where we have access to the right level of information, so we get that kind of situational awareness of what's going on the system.
Yeah.
Allows us to operate it much more effectively, because if we know what's going on, then we know like what to do to deal with it.
Yeah. So we've got the kind of the complexity of dispatching lots of things in a very short period of time. We've got the kind of the information shortfall of having many, many smaller assets with perhaps not the same quality of information coming into the control room. I think we also have a sort of 15-minute rule at the moment, which is linked to kind of the typical dispatch duration of a battery. Could you give a little bit more color around the 15-minute rule and perhaps how that might be changing?
Yeah, so that's actually another link through to information. So as you say, 15 minutes sort of seem to be the typical duration of a battery. So we have a limit at the minute that we will only dispatch a battery for 15 minutes because we can be sure that it will deliver that. Beyond that, it becomes much more uncertain.
Okay.
With some of the changes that we're proposing around sort of information flows and other things, we can actually lift that rule off and say, actually, if you give us different information, we don't need to put a 15-minute limit on our dispatch instructions, because we would have more certainty about what you're able to do and then whether you're delivering or not against what you've said you'll do.
And this feels like a win-win, right? So this feels like the control room engineer they will receive more information over a longer period of time to better understand kind of what storage can do. But also the storage assets themselves will see better and longer dispatch. And so it feels like one of those ones where it when it happens, which is potentially Q1-ish of next year, kind of TBC exactly when that goes live. But that will be a big thing for storage as well as the improvements to the bulk dispatch.
Yeah, I think from our perspective, so we've said that we will be able to operate the power system for at zero carbon for short periods in 2025.
Okay.
Which is really close.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, huge investment coming into the UK energy market, particularly into the battery section of the market. So yeah, these changes that are coming in stages over the next sort of 6-12 months, keep us on the path to being able to operate a zero carbon power system. Can't do it without batteries. And ensures that we're providing sort of open, fair access to batteries and giving those routes to market that allow people to stack up their, you know, business cases, whatever they might have been. Yeah.
So I think that's really probably the most important question, right? Which is, I think there's a lot of win-wins along the way to get to that sort of future world. How does ESO and kind of the process of change, how do they give enough confidence to those investors who'll be looking at the UK, but will also be looking at markets like ERCOT, or they'll be looking at NEM in Australia and be thinking about where they put their batteries? How would they get confidence that coming into the UK market and being able to access the revenues through the balancing mechanism, how do they get confidence that will happen and that they should be investing in the UK?
I think the UK is a massive success story for batteries. If I think back to, I don't know what year it was, a few years ago when we introduced this brand new product called Enhanced Frequency Response, which was designed for batteries specifically. Where we've come from then, which was only maybe 6-ish years ago, to where we are now is huge. We've had such a rapid development. And we said, there's a lot of battery capacity wanting to connect to networks. So the interest is there. What we're doing is both from a technology point of view, so some of the things that we've talked about, but also from a market design point of view, making sure that the routes to market are there and that they're fair and accessible so that investors can look at the market and build a business case. Not everyone centers their business case around the balancing mechanism, right? There's different models.
Yeah.
So our role is to keep on top of that and keep pushing forward. So all the technology things that we talked about that just makes the balancing mechanism fair, but actually some of the things that we're doing in market design as well. So this year before Christmas, we should be increasing the volume of dynamic regulation that we procure, which is one of our frequency response products that is dominated by batteries. It's just, you know, all of these little pieces together allow investors confidence that there's different revenues that can be stacked together to create that investable business case.
And I think there's huge confidence in those frequency response services, DC, DM and DR. I think they've been a massive success story. I think if you go back 3 years, you get the amount that you're procuring now is almost three times what you're procuring going back 2 years. And you are procuring that at a price which is a fraction of what it kind of has been procured for. And so I totally agree, it's a massive success story. That brings us on to, I think, maybe the kind of last question of all of this. And it's amazing we've gone through an entire conversation on the balancing mechanism without saying two words that are skip and rate. but can I ask you what a skip rate is?
Well, that is the million-dollar question. So a skip rate is where an asset hasn't been dispatched and it should have been.
Okay.
However, as we were talking about right at the start of the conversation, when the control room are looking at dispatching units, they won't necessarily just go up the price stack and go, right, cheapest first, then the next, then the next, then the next, because sometimes we need to procure a particular characteristic and you might need to go to number 5 in the queue or number 8 to get it.
So there's a system reason why you might need to do that.
Yeah.
E.g. a constraint or an inertia requirement type thing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And I don't think that is always as transparent as it could be. So when you're outside looking in, you're sometimes sat there going, well, hang on, I was definitely cheaper than that asset that's been dispatched, so why wasn't I used first?
Yeah.
And the terminology skip rate has kind of started being used to describe that. This there's quite a lot of discussion about what a skip rate actually is, because there are valid reasons that units are not dispatched sometime. Okay. But what we absolutely need to get to is all of the technology stuff that I've mentioned that means there are no barriers for technology reasons or something else that an asset wasn't used. So there will always be instances where we might have needed, I don't know, vaults in the Mersey region. So we've had to use unit A and not, you know, 1, 2, and 3 that were cheaper than it. But anything at the minute that is being skipped because we can't get to it quick enough,
yes,
or our procedure wasn't quite right, that will all come out with the series of changes that are coming in over the next sort of 6-12 months.
Okay. And people really care about this, right? Because batteries, they're doing a lot of things well, like they're doing the wholesale trading well that runs up until gate closure, and they're doing the reserve and response products reasonably well. And the thing that kind of, where they maybe feel like there's more value on the table is it within the balancing mechanism, solving some of these kind of super fast response and locational type problems. And the way that the industry is looking at it is kind of going, well, skip rates is kind of is a metric that we can use to work out kind of how much the value we're capturing, how much the value we're kind of leaving on the table. And so there's a big piece of work, OBP, to then resolve some of that and bring skip rates down, so fewer things being skipped. How do ESO want to track this, and how can investors who are looking at it, how can they get confidence from kind of the direction that's moving?
Yeah, and it's really important that, like, everyone in that sector is confident, and the investors, the battery developers, the optimizer, everyone. What we've done actually is try to bring this all together so everything's in one place. We actually held an event in the middle of October where we talked through all of the things that we've been talking about today. So about information, about some of the technology releases, about market design issues, and put all of that together in one kind of plan and said, look, this is what we are committing to do. We can show you a pipeline of changes that we're going to make. And also said, and for each of those changes, this is the impact that we're expecting it to have. What we've also committed to do is, we talked a bit just about skip rates, is to create a sort of agreed industry standard, if you like, of skip rates. So let's all agree the categories of skip rates. We will categorize all of our decisions within those, and we will use an independent party to kind of review all of that as well.
Okay.
Make all of that public. And then as and when all of these different things release that we're talking about, we should be able to see the impact in those skip rates coming down in each of the categories.
And this is something that Modo will love, and I think industry will love, right? Mm-hmm. It's going back to kind of the, what does the pure data say? And we can go from the metric to get us some confidence in terms of, is it moving in the right direction? Is it not? I suppose the obvious question to this is, well, if it doesn't change, what might we do? Is there something that we might think about in terms of changes we might make to OBP to kind of do further improvements? Or is it kind of, we're pretty certain that OBP is going to solve the problem, it's just a matter of time?
We're really confident in the plan that we've set out that will make tangible changes. There will always be some evolution, always going to be fine tuning of, actually, if we did this or that, there's probably some market design changes that we can make as well, which are a bit more long run, because we need to do them sort of jointly with industry, not just, you know, within our four walls. But yeah, like, confident that the OBP this December and other changes will make a visible difference.
Okay, yeah, we're really excited to see it come through and to track it and talk about it, because if you need to check out a sort of intro to skip rates, there is one on the Modo platform, and I'm sure the slides from that BM event are also available online as well. So yeah, there we go. Good. Well, that brings us to the end of the BM and batteries in the BM, which has been an absolute pleasure. I have two final questions. One is there anything that you would like to plug? This can be personal or this could be professional. Anything you'd like to talk about?
Oh, anything I'd like to plug. So I've already talked about the event that we had on Monday. So I guess I'd say the thing I want to plug, which isn't really plug, is, like, come and talk to us. So I have been doing this role in the ESO for a year now, and I've spent quite a lot of time talking to developers, and less so to investors, actually. We really value just talking to people and understanding some of the drivers that are behind people's questions, like what people are actually and what they're worried about. So if I could plug anything, it would be like, come and talk to us. Okay. Like, we're always happy to talk.
And how does someone do that?
So I'm pretty easy to find on social media. All the events and things that we mentioned, they always have contact details on. So yeah, can reach out to anyone in my team or in National Control as well. We're always happy to listen, to talk, to come and talk to other people as well.
Okay. That's I think you'll have people taking you up on that.
Yeah.
And they already do, so that's good. And then the last part is your contrarian view. So is there something that you believe that you think a majority of other people don't?
Oh, so I have to be careful with this, because I remember a few years ago standing up at a very well-known battery forum that tends to take place in the autumn and announcing that the ESO was not going to sign any more long-term contracts.
Okay.
And that caused a flurry of excitement. So what would I say if I was going to be contrary? Probably that things are not going to be stable. So we're in a world of change. Things are going to keep changing. So we mentioned our frequency response markets, DC, DR and DM. Mm-hmm. They're amazing. They're just getting your head around how they've been designed and how they're operating is blows my mind. No doubt they will evolve at some time. And I guess my thing would be, change isn't scary. What's scary is if people can't see it's coming. So we're just in a world now where we have to learn that change is constant. And, you know, if you build a business case based on everything as it looks today, I can guarantee in 5 years it will look different.
Mm. I think that's a nice message to end on, isn't it? It's like the control room, something we look for, you know, huge amounts of stability and certainty. It's probably a good thing that they're the ones, you know, thinking about change and how this is going to look in the future. So yeah, a good message to end on. Thank you, Claire, for coming on.
Oh, thank you.